from KUER News in Salt Lake City. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The conversation and debate over the new Mormon policy on same-sex couples and their children doesn't seem to be letting up all that much. People are still trying to make sense of it or justify it or explain it. And that last part, the explanation part, is what we've been trying to get at over the last week or so. That's why we went to the source. We asked for someone from the LDS Church itself to join us. After some consideration, they have turned us down. But you don't need an official representative to explain Mormon doctrine. And if you're going to understand the basis of this policy, not agree with it, but understand it, you have to know how Mormon doctrine works. Because Mormons have a very detailed plan of how the world works for families and sex and an afterlife. And as Mormon historian and scholar Russell Stevenson says, it's hard to imagine where LGBT people fit in that plan. He'll join us today to explain it after the news. This week on Video West, see Scott Raya's film about what it means to be gay and Mormon, which is timely for obvious reasons. The story plays out on the campus of BYU with the experiences of gay students there, and it's built around the concept of uncertainty. The film was made before the LDS Church issued its new policy on same-sex couples and their children, so this was when gay Mormons were wondering where they fit in their church and whether they could manage to stay with the faith. Go see it at videowest.org. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are going to continue our coverage of the new Mormon policy on same-sex couples and their children. By now, you know the LDS Church has instructed local leaders that people in same-sex relationships are to be considered apostates, and that the children in sole custody of these couples will not be allowed to be named or baptized or given full access to membership in the church until they become adults and renounce their parents' relationship. Now, so far, we've been able to explore the reaction to the policy, which has been, of course, passionate and emotional. We've talked about the context in which the policy is playing out socially and politically. What we haven't been able to do yet is explain from the Mormon Church's position where the policy fits into their doctrine and their worldview. And we hoped to get that explanation from the church itself. We asked them to join us, even offered an entire hour. And I think they considered it. They said they did, but earlier in the week, they declined. They did send us a statement. I won't read it all, but what it says is that they have done plenty to explain this policy, and then they've made the explanation available for all to see at their website. We have a link to that on ours. The statement said, "No church places more emphasis on families and children than we do, and people who are still interested in the topic can go to the website and draw their own conclusions." Well, today in the program, we're going to go ahead anyway. Of course, defenders of the policy say this is just a reflection of church doctrine. So we've asked the historian and Mormon scholar Russell Stevenson to join us to take us through that, explain the doctrine at the heart of Mormonism's attitude toward same-sex couples. We've had Russell Stevenson on the program before. He's an historian who's written about race and sexuality in Mormon history. He's the author of the book For the Cause of Righteousness, which looks at the history of blacks and Mormonism around the world. Stevenson is a doctoral student at Michigan State University. He is in California today giving a paper at the African Studies Association Conference. So he's joining us from a studio, the Bill Corkery Productions Studio in San Diego. And Russell Stevenson, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning, Doug. Good to be here.
Well, I want to dig into this a little bit later, but I do want to at least make a reference to or a question anyway about whether you see parallels between the Mormon Church's dealing with, blacks in the priesthood and this particular issue. Are you seeing any parallels in this?
Whenever we tell the story of a particular group or identity within the Latter-day Saint tradition or any tradition for that matter, we need to exercise a double dose of caution when we start engaging in, what academics tend to call intersectionality, right? Where, you compare and contrast the plights of either African Americans or Africans or LGBTs or people who identify as those as having same sex or experiencing same sex attraction. Obviously, to some extent, we can see certain parallels. In the sense that there is now a policy in place that restricts certain people from receiving certain ordinances. Mm-hmm. By the same token, If you look at the history of peoples of African descent within the Latter-day Saint tradition, you know, we do have a clear precedent for, you know, for African Americans holding the priesthood, mm-hmm. Elijah Abels, Walker Lewis, and a handful of others. So while the comparison can be meaningful, and we can certainly look at it from the perspective of an institution drawing a line,
it's apples to apples.
We should be careful,
right? Apples to apples. We're not comparing the same things.
Oftentimes you find that they are slightly different. Now, that does not delegitimize either's plight, right?
Of course. I guess what I was getting at, and I'll ask you more particular questions about that, actually, because I think it raises questions about how Mormons see revelation working. I'll ask you about that later. But what I'm interested in, I guess, in particular is this is a policy. This is something that is found in a handbook that most don't have access to. This is for local leaders, bishops, I guess, and state presidents, branch presidents or whatever. And so is it set in stone, or is it something that could budge, could move, could shift a bit?
You know, according to Eric Hawkins' statement to the press, he made it explicitly clear the handbook is indeed
policy. He's a spokesman
for the
church, I should explain.
Indeed. It's a policy, not a doctrine, right? He made that distinction crystal clear. And, you know, if you do look at the manual, and as a child, we were kind of a goofy family in that we had fun looking at the manual, looking at different things. There are any number of things that are quite banal, right? They're quite mundane, and they don't have a lot of doctrinal significance, right? It could be dealing with temporal affairs, you know, things dealing with, you know, the very earthly administration of the church. And these are things that have been adjusted in the past. Mm-hmm. And, you know, speaking to your earlier question, you can, again, you see that towards the late 60s, early 70s especially, church leaders are referring to the restriction on peoples of African and African American descent as being a policy, right? So you do see a similar use of language, though I think that there are some nuances in how that language is being used that are meaningful and worth discussing.
I want to jump right into the doctrine. You've said that Mormonism is the most, and I'll quote you here, heteronormative theology there is. Explain what that means, and because we have to now put this in context of the fact that Mormons believe in a mother in heaven, a mother and a father, and that Mormons believe that even God has sex, right?
You know, we believe in heavenly parents. You know, we've had that essay come out rather recently, essentially acknowledging that the doctrine of Heavenly Mother isn't just some sort of folk saying, mm-hmm. right, but that it has been to some extent assimilated within the Mormon corpus of doctrine. But, you know, ultimately, you know, we have to acknowledge that, right? We because, you know, you have a father and a mother figure. They're both embodied. Right. And as, you know, James E. Talmage said, even back in 1914, you know, man is man, woman is woman, fundamentally, unchangeably, eternally, right? That is his quote. Now, there has been the work of some very, very bright scholars who've questioned that and probed that and said, okay, well, you know, maybe, you know, if you get to the foundation of Mormon doctrine, there's a little bit more budge room. But ultimately, you know, we have to acknowledge that we believe in a kind of cosmic heterosexuality. Now, we shouldn't go, you know, we start delving into the realm of speculation as to what that looks like or what that feels like. But
it's
have
important
to acknowledge
to understand,
that gender
right?
identity is it's part of the system.
And you've said in that sense, it's hard to imagine a family for Mormons who have this worldview that is outside of that context.
You know, in some sense, yes. Now, to be sure, there is a strong strain of Mormon universalism within our doctrines, in the sense that, you know, we allow for lots of leniences, right? For example, you know, we offer the ordinances of baptism for the dead, assuming, okay, they did not have the opportunity. And there are several comments within, you know, the teachings of Latter-day Saint prophets that also promise the prospects of marriage to those who do not have the opportunity in this life, right? So, while, you know, obviously this heteronormative way of thinking is deeply embedded within Mormonism, there is room for, you know, later change, like later redemption, as it were, or a later adjustment based on, you know, on situations that people can't always control in this life.
You know what is so interesting? I wanted to ask you if this was unique to Mormons, how extremely literal this belief is for Mormons. There is nothing terribly fuzzy about the way Mormons think of what they call the plan of salvation. This is what happened before, and Mormons believe that there was this sort of pre-mortal life and that they come here for a particular reason, and then if they behave properly, they end up in a very particular place in heaven. There are these three glories laid out. It's, I mean, it's such a fully developed cosmology, which makes talking about where gay people fit all the more complicated, it seems. But are Mormons unique in just how specific that worldview, that cosmology is?
I mean, particularly so. You know, Neil A. Maxwell, a former apostle for the LDS Church, he once joked that, you know, writing out the plan of salvation on a chalkboard was kind of like drawing out a detailed floor plan for a house.
Right.
And, you know, he said so ruefully, he said this is rather unfortunate in the sense that it diminishes the individuality of this plan for, you know, for each person as they seek to, you know, gain a greater intimacy with Jesus Christ and as they seek to understand their own place, you know, in this plan. So on the one hand, you know, we need to be candid in saying that, you know, this plan is transparent. It is relatively clear. You look at Doctrine and Covenants section 76, and it talks about, you know, varying gradations of glory in the afterlife. But even within the context of that, you know, there are scriptures that say it's much more intimate than that. You know, there is no kingdom without a place, and there is no place without a kingdom, the Mormon scripture says. So I'm inclined to think that, you know, while we can use the celestial, terrestrial, and telestial gradations as some sort of general way of understanding the, you know, the post-mortal Latter-day Saint experience, you know, by the same token, I do think that it's a lot more specific to our individual experiences than that.
So are these folk beliefs for Mormons? Because, you know, conservative...
Be more specific.
Conservative Orthodox Mormons... you know, I've heard them sort of riff on this, that, okay, if you make it to the celestial kingdom, you can visit – I mean, this is how particular it gets. You can visit people in the terrestrial kingdom. You can visit people in the telestial kingdom, but you can't visit upward. And people in the celestial kingdom can have sex, but people in the terrestrial kingdom cannot have sex. I mean, again, very specific. They lay it out in very particular terms. So the question is, are these just sort of – folk beliefs, beliefs they've gotten from leaders, maybe at the podium, maybe at a church class, riffing on the doctrine? Or is this, in fact, particular to the doctrine? Is it laid out in the doctrine?
Sure, sure. I mean, you know, if you look at Doctrine and Covenants section 76, you know, which, you know, is the foundation text for understanding, you know, much of the post-mortal experience within Mormon doctrine, it is to some extent specific, but it doesn't talk about traveling between kingdoms.
Yeah.
Right, that isn't in the text.
Right.
So if we're being real about this, then yes, that interpretation is in fact an interpolation.
Yeah.
Right, and you know, Latter-day Saints, they look at these things and sometimes it feels weird or doesn't make sense to them, so they actually try to translate it into something that they experience on this earth. Right, because there's the verse in Moses where it says that everything that you see on this earth is in some way a mirror of what you see, you know, in the heavens. So we say, okay, well, you know, because I can travel between different, you know, different social circles or different realms here on this earth, surely that will be the case in the afterlife. But ultimately, we need to acknowledge those things for what they are, and that is, you know, speculation that has not been through the canonization process. It has not been through the same kind of vetting process that, you know, the Doctrine and Covenants or the Book of Mormon or other canonized works have been through.
What you're saying is that Mormon doctrine is not necessarily fixed. Maybe it's not like the American Constitution that keeps kind of – it has basic principles, but new generations come to it and kind of adjust it based on the time. But that there is some malleable quality to it, it seems to me, that what you're saying, which gives – I have to say, although I don't see what kind of hope, but it may give some hope to some gay Latter-day Saints that maybe down the line there's some actual room for a fully realized gay person in the Mormon eternal scheme?
I mean, that's an interesting question. So, you know, speaking to canonicity within the Latter-day Saint tradition, it is hard to be too much of a fundamentalist and be a, you know, someone who accepts Latter-day Saint scripture, because the very process by which much of Latter-day Saint scripture has been produced defies fundamentalist approaches to scripture, right? The Book of Mormon is based on notions of continuing revelation. The Doctrine and Covenants is, you know, it's revelation after revelation experienced in real time. Now, speaking to your question of, you know, whether there is, you know, some kind of hope for, you know, a person who identifies as lesbian, gay, bisexual, transsexual, you know, or queer, or, you know, whatever identifier they choose to use, I always believe there's hope. I mean, that is the foundation of the Latter-day Saint gospel, that God will give us every opportunity to live as close to Zion as we possibly can live. You know, J. Reuben Clark made that comment that, you know, he was a former First Presidency for the Church, also a former Undersecretary of State. And, you know, he said that God will, you know, bless us to the maximum for even just the smallest amount of obedience, and then he will punish us to the minimum for, you know, the greatest amount of obedience, or disobedience, rather. So we need to acknowledge that, you know, however this all plays out, that foundationally, God is a merciful God, and the law of mercy is just as much a part of the gospel as, you know, any kinds of conversation about family or heteronormativity.
Russell Stevenson is with us, an historian who's written about race and sexuality in Mormonism. He wrote the article Manly Virtue, which looks at Mormon male sexuality in the 1800s. It appeared in the journal Dialogue. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are continuing the conversation about the LDS Church's new policy on same-sex couples and their children. It's a story that doesn't seem to be going away right now. The New York Times editorial board weighed in on the matter with a piece on the op-ed pages of their paper just today, which is just to say that people are still reeling by the policy and trying to make sense of it or explain it. That's what we're trying to do, is explain the policy. We were hoping to have it explained by a representative from the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. They declined to join us, so we've asked Russell Stevenson, a Mormon historian who's written about race and sexuality, to join us. He doesn't speak for the church. I guess we should make that clear as well. He's the author of the book For the Cause of Righteousness. Okay, Russell Stevenson, let me ask you about the concept of marriage, because this is, you hear this all the time, how the concept of marriage in Mormonism is really critical. Explain how it's different from other Christian faiths, because you say Mormons tie marriage directly to salvation. Explain that, if you would.
Sure. You know, in much of Christianity, you know, marriage is seen as a holy institution. Let's not diminish that. But ultimately, the relationship between husband and wife within much of Christianity, at least I should say, you know, according to creedal Christianity, not, you know, different adaptations that have, you know, developed over the course of, you know, the previous couple generations. But it's the marriage institution is seen as an institution for this life only. Right, it is meant to do a number of things. Right, it is meant to, you know, edify a person, to teach them how to serve, to teach them how to submit to their spouse. But ultimately, in the afterlife, that relationship will change. Right, you change from being husband and wife to now being fellow creatures of an Almighty God, and, you know, you spend eternity worshiping Him as such.
Yeah.
Now, within the Latter-day Saint tradition, marriage is quite a bit more than that. Marriage is, in fact, the bedrock for, you know, creating the world in which we hope to live. You know, I think of the anecdote by Lorenzo Snow. And, you know, one day he was looking at some children playing with clay. And, he saw them toying around with this, and they're making it into little balls. And he said, you know, these young men, and in this case it was young men's group, these young men are making worlds for themselves, and this is representative of what we are doing all of us are seeking to make a world in which we want to live, right? And ultimately, I mean, that is a major part of Latter-day Saint soteriology, and that is that we as people will have the opportunity to live in that world where that we want to live in, and that we will not be forced to live according to a law or a glory that does not resonate with us and that we do not seek to have. So similarly, you know, the institution of marriage, you know, by engaging that, it does put you on a track within Mormonism. You know, the hope being that at some point, you know, you will be emulating your heavenly parents. You know, you will be having children as they did.
Right.
And that is the point. That is one of the points of this life.
If you're heterosexual.
Yes.
Right.
And to some extent, I mean, this is one of those things that, you know, Neil A. Maxwell would call a wintry doctrine. And that is that, you know, heterosexuality is, in fact, embedded in, you know, the Latter-day Saint plan of salvation. Now, that being said, much of this depends on on whether you see one's, you know, sexuality as deeply embedded in one's identity or not.
Well, I want to come to that because that's a huge question. But let me
That's foundational.
Foundational.
Right?
Let's stick on marriage for just a moment because I have to ask, which seems to be a kind of skeptical question, but I'm not sure how you can say the Mormon idea of marriage, or not you, but others who say the Mormon idea of marriage is a traditional one, you know, a heteronormative one, if it includes polygamy. Doesn't the Mormon eternal concept of marriage allow for polygamy?
Right. And, you know, of course, now we have to deal with what the word traditional really means. And that's the kind of word that is packed with worlds of meaning, right? I mean, this is not the only kind of conversation where people struggle over, like, what is tradition? I mean, you can have a whole class, for example, on what is traditional Africa, right? There are so many different variations. So speaking to this example in particular, when Latter-day Saints use that word, and, you know, if I'm choosing to, you know, understand their reading of that word charitably, I'm inclined to think that they're seeing that as a representation of what they see as traditional heterosexual relationships, right? So they see heterosexuality as normative. So polygamy, you know, it certainly does, you know, deviate from, obviously, this goes without saying, deviate from, you know, what we now see as marriage, but it is still heteronormative. So I'm inclined to think that is, you know, the meaning that they are ascribing to the word traditional, right? Traditional slash heteronormative.
But it's not what Anthony Kennedy had in mind or Justice Roberts had in mind when they were making those questions.
No.
I mean, this is where Mormons tend to stand out. And would you just answer that question directly? Mormons still do allow for polygamy in their eternal scheme, correct? Am I right about that?
I mean, according to, you know, let's just unpack that statement a little bit. You know, when a man is, you know, a man and woman are sealed, and let's say that wife passes away, and this is not this is obviously a relatively common occurrence, that man is allowed to be sealed to his next wife.
Yeah.
And, you know,
it's easy to see that
as a kind of as polygamy.
Yeah.
Now, how does that shake out in the eternities? You know, that's not something that's been explained in canon or any kind of official statement. But that's how the policy stands now.
So Mormon doctrine. Does Mormon doctrine see anyone in the afterlife alone, living a solitary life? Because the temporal image of a gay Latter-day Saint, one who's properly living within the confines of Mormon rules, they can't bring a boyfriend to church or a girlfriend to church, or shouldn't anyway, I suppose, at least now.
Well, I mean, hold
on, let me finish the question, though.
Okay.
They are supposed to live a life, a solitary life, at least according to the dictates of their own sexuality. They can get married to in a heterosexual relationship and not be alone. But the way a gay Latter-day Saint, as I understand it, is supposed to live properly within the church doctrine today is they can have friends, of course, and they can have family, but they can't have a husband. They can't have a wife. They live a more solitary existence, don't they?
You know, there was that book that came out from Deseret Book some years back, you know, co-written by Ty Mansfield called, you know, In Quiet Desperation. and to, you know, the book was in large part about the experiences of Stuart Mattis, who in some ways, I mean, he was a high-profile Latter-day Saint who experienced same-sex attraction. And he struggled. He struggled so much to live up to the standards that the church had placed upon him. You know, he read his scriptures twice as much, right? He did everything that he thought would help either change him or at least help him to endure his experiences. And ultimately, it did not work. And he was found dead on the doorsteps of the church, having just committed suicide. So we need to remember that when we're talking about these questions, I mean, there is a real human cost. Now, speaking to your point about, you know, whether a gay couple can, in fact, come to church, they can, right? That is, I mean, and obviously there are going to be local circumstances where, you know, Latter-day Saints are more exclusive. And, you know, obviously that's something that needs to be condemned. But they can come to church. It's just that they cannot, you know, contract a gay marriage and enjoy this, you know, enjoy the fellowship
of the church, at least
without some kind of disciplinary counsel.
Right. And I know, but so if they decide, so if a man is married to, mm-hmm. you know, a gay man, they're married, gay men, they come to church, they're officially apostates now. I mean, there's no fudge room anymore on this. The policy laid that out. So I guess, yes, technically they can come and sit in the pew, but everyone knows they're apostates now. That does
no,
seem to
no,
change
let, things. Let's be real about what that is. I just wanted to make sure that distinction was clear,
sure.
that they could in fact come to church, but you know they're standing to some degree right now. And again, let's be clear that, you know, the handbook doesn't dictate the outcomes of that disciplinary council.
Sure,
but it does
call them apostates, Russell.
It does. Yep. It does cite it as an example of apostasy. That's not something that can be.
Well, go back to
around.
The question of whether this person. I mean, does Mormon doctrine see anyone in the afterlife, in the bigger scheme, really living a life alone? Mormons
right.
don't see that. No one's alone. Mormons believe in big families and collectives, so being alone doesn't fit into the Mormon scheme of things.
Well, certainly not within. Okay, so again, let's get into the text of, you know, regarding, you know, the afterlife, section 76, as well as section 131 of the Doctrine and Covenants. In these sections, it does, especially section 131, it does indicate that you can actually be unmarried and be in the celestial kingdom. You will just not inherit the same kind of glory that a heterosexual married couple would. And moreover, you know, you would not have a family. So that place does exist within Mormon cosmology. Hmm. That being said, though—
Is that where gay people fit? Or were they,
I mean,
technically?
And this is where – this is the question where, I mean, does one see— one's sexuality as being primarily a temporal experience and as something that can be disassociated from one's core identity. Now, there are many, many LGBTQIA individuals who would say, no, this is a fundamental part of who I am,
mm-hmm.
right? And this is the kind of life that I want to live,
right?
Right? And, you know, it may sound strange in a conversation about Orthodox Mormonism to cite Marx, right? But let's do that and say that, you know, Marx said that, you know, men are able to make their own history, but not under conditions of their own making, right? So what ends up happening is that you have people who experience same-sex attraction, and they are able to make a world for themselves as they see fit. So let's say I'm certainly not in a place to, you know, give any kind of eternal judgment on people who experience this, but I firmly believe that you can live gospel principles even while not being a member of the church, right? So let's say you have a gay couple.
Why would you do that? Because you're going to wait until later when God figures it out, and the humans who are officiating on Earth figure it out. Is that why you would do something like that?
I mean, it really depends on one's. I mean, if you do not believe that the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is what it claims itself to be, well, you know, then you would just leave it behind. If you see some kind of authority, right, mm-hmm. or some kind of theological gravitas, then you know, then you would say, okay, well, you know what, I am not able to be a member of the church at this time because I'm in this gay relationship, but I see so many good things in the Latter-day Saint tradition, and therefore I will try to emulate that. Again, coming back to this idea of Mormon universalism, God blesses, according to Mormon doctrine, those who live to the best degree that they are able, And that includes for those, you know, who have been excommunicated from the church. Sometimes we assume that the excommunication is the end of a person's spiritual journey, but it is not. Right? That spiritual journey continues on. And as I said, the law of mercy is just as powerful as, in fact, I would even say more powerful in Mormon doctrine than many other laws.
Let me ask you, I want to get to this idea of the really core identity of people, their sexuality, their spirituality. For some people, Kendall Wilcox is one who talks about how powerful his sense of spirituality is, and it's as powerful to him as his sexual orientation. He's a gay Latter-day Saint. And we've had him on the program. He was with us last Monday. Talking about this particular policy. But one thing people don't understand is just how important the physical body is to Mormons. I mean, you've described it to us as this is the game changer. And Mormons believe that people lived before in this pre-existent state, in pre-mortality, essentially. Now, here's the question. Theoretically, were there any gay people there? Were these spirits gay?
Right.
Or did they decide to come to mortality and choose to be afflicted with this burden of sexuality and they'll be cured later?
Right. And I mean, first of all, I see the word cure as being problematic for
but do they stop being gay? Whatever you want to call it.
Right.
In the Mormon scheme.
Right. I distance myself from that because it evokes like images of like electroshock therapy and all kinds
of
awful things. So, you know, speaking to Latter-day Saint cosmology, the conventional wisdom about, you know, sexuality within the Latter-day Saint cosmology has been that homosexuality is indeed a temporal experience, something to be confined to this world and this world only. Now, why is it that many people are born with these kinds of feelings? And you know, at this point, I think we can all agree that there are plenty of people who are born, you know, experiencing these kinds of feelings. Why is it? That is something that, frankly, we don't have a lot of answers to.
Well, there's no doctrine.
I don't mean to be dodgy, but
sounds so dodgy, though, Russell. I get what you're saying, but so what do Mormons? So Mormons don't have an answer to this question that between that pre-existent state when they were supposedly straight spirits and coming here, what happened to make them born gay?
Well,
that's so.
And the reason we don't have a direct answer for that is the same reason we don't have the direct answer for a lot of experiences in mortality. Right. Like, there's a range of things where we'd say, hey, listen, this isn't, you know, this is not fit with the grand eternal scheme of things, right? This is not, you know, in this case, you know, this doesn't fit with a heavenly father and a heavenly mother. Or, you know, you could point to any number of things and say that we don't know why people experience the things that they do, except as something that is a deeply rooted part of their personal spiritual journey, right? We can't ever leave that aside.
Right, but it's such an unsatisfactory answer if you're a gay Latter-day Saint to say, I don't understand. If you're now, for a lot of people, they're just dismissing this as absurd theology to justify ignorance and bigotry.
Mm-hmm.
But let's go with the earnest gay Latter-day Saints, a Kendall Wilcox, for example, a Mitch Main, for example, who we had on the program.
Sure.
They're trying to figure out where they fit in the eternal scheme of things, and no one can give them an explanation for that. They're told they're like alcoholics, they're afflicted with this burden, and someday they'll figure it out. But that's not terribly satisfactory.
And Latter-day Saints, I mean, and this is something that I've seen a lot of, where we grasp for explanations for things. You even see this in Job. Right, where, you know, Job is experiencing, you know, a variety of things, and his friends come and try to, you know, explain away, like all the things that he's so okay. You must be sinning, right? You must be a sinful person, and therefore, you know, you're experiencing the judgment of God, and you know that is one of the most powerful doctrines of Job, and that is that they are the ones who are seen as the villain, right? They're the ones who are getting it wrong because Job's experiences. I mean, they were his and his alone, and God had his eye on him from the beginning, right? So we need to understand that, you know, when we're talking about individuals' experiences, as heteronormative Latter-day Saints, we need to take special care to validate those experiences as they struggle to make sense of who they are. Gender is, I mean, we understand that, you know, according to the Family Proclamation, gender is an essential part of our identity and purpose.
Right.
Well, I tend to read that as, you know, not being something that is fixed. It's not something that's reified. It is a journey. And those journey, I mean, and God is going to help us through that journey. So is that a frustrating answer? Yes, we all deal with frustrating and mind-numbingly annoying things in this life. So we need to validate those experiences.
But you're saying that Mormon doctrine makes way for a person to be gay and still still go to sort of some version of heaven. It's not the same heaven as the straight folks, but
right.
I mean, or do they become cured? Again, I won't use that word. Do they become lifted of this burden of homosexuality and they're straight again in the afterlife?
I mean, ultimately, you know, if you look at Doctrine and Covenants section 76, you know, it gives you some indication of what kinds of people end up where. Right, you know, the people who end up in the celestial kingdom, they're members of the church. They've been faithful to the covenant of, you know, the firstborn and these kinds of things. But you know, if you look at those who live in the terrestrial kingdom, as it is styled in the Doctrine and Covenants, these people are people who are moral, upstanding individuals. They enjoy the presence of Jesus Christ or the light of Jesus Christ, and in many ways, I mean, they are people that we should aspire to be like. And frankly, you know, Latter-day Saint Scripture allows for homosexuals to receive that kind of glory. Whether that happens or not, obviously, none of us are in a place to say. But I know of several individuals where, based on my own judgment, I would say that is an honorable person. And I would never be caught dare saying that, you know, they will be cast into some kind of hellfire, you know, for living out this part of their lives.
What Mormons say, if I get this right, we'll go back to something you were talking about earlier, is that...
And let me just interject real quick. When you say what Mormons say, I mean, that is a generalization, but let's go with that.
Okay, you're right. Because it seems like, I think you're right, Mormons are all over the place on this, which does make it more confusing. There are essences of Mormon doctrine that you find. You referenced this Doctrine and Covenants 76, for example. But there's a lot of freelancing going on with these. And I guess that's what happens in all religious institutions. But let me move on to this question, though. So... what you're saying is that creation is an ongoing process, essentially, is what you're saying, and that it would be possible then for a homosexual person to make the world they wanted to make for themselves. And there was this – I want to refer to this column by the Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby, who's an active Latter-day Saint, although a progressive one.
I love his stuff.
Right. And he wrote this piece where he talked about these three degrees of glory. And he said – let me read some of this. He said, I realized the beauty of the three degrees of glory. I didn't have to be church-approved valiant. I just had to be comfortable with myself and where I'm going. Mm. He writes, once you admit your telestial nature, which is the bottom rung – for Mormons, he said, things get so much easier. It's almost impossible to feel guilty about not measuring up to someone else's expectation when you no longer have to bother. For example, people who want to go to the celestial kingdom have to stay for Sunday school. Telestial spirits can go home and eat leftover pizza. Celestial spirits, he says, have to concern themselves with having a spouse and kids for eternity. After we're dead, telestial spirits are free to stay out as late as we want. We don't have to get up and go to work. Telestial spirits cannot be threatened or coerced into certain behavior because, and this is an important point, we're already fine with what we've got coming to us. Is Kirby right that in this sort of eternal scheme, you can make your own place for it? You can let the celestial guys go to church, but you can live in another kingdom and get along with everybody else.
And, you know, I find the way Kirby has expressed that, I think that resonates with a real current within Latter-day Saint doctrine.
Yeah.
And the idea that, you know, we will receive the desires of our hearts, right? That, I mean, that is language drawn directly from the Book of Mormon. And if you do not want to live out the life of a heteronormative family, then God will never compel you to do so. Right? The doctrine of, I mean, we talked about the premortal life before, and according to, you know, how the Latter-day Saints understand that, I mean, the power to choose, the power to make your world as you see fit, I mean, that was what the conflict was all about, right? That was why we went to, you know, to some kind of war with words, you know, with the adversary, is the right to make ourselves, to make our identities as we feel that works for us the best and fits with what we want out of this life.
Russell Stevenson is with us. He's the author of the book For the Cause of Righteousness and the article Manly Virtue for the journal Dialogue. We need to take another quick break, but we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are trying to continue the conversation about the LDS Church's new controversial policy on same-sex couples and their children. We have with us Russell Stevenson, an historian who's written about race and sexuality in Mormonism. Okay, I wanted to ask the question about, well, let's talk about sex, about how Mormons...
Let's talk about sex.
That sounded weird. how do Mormons see sex? Because over the centuries, it seems like different Christian sects have been conflicted about sex. They see it as carnal and dirty and base. But Mormons don't see it that way. As long as it's within the proper bounds, Mormons all are for sex, I guess.
Well, theoretically, right? I mean, I think if you were to talk to some marriage and family therapists at BYU, they would say, well, you know, because there's still a real sense of, you know, guilt and shame that tends to surround it, especially, you know, in the transition
from going
single.
That's in practice, but in theory, sex is good.
In theory.
Yes.
Yeah. In theory, you know, sexuality is in Latter-day Saint praxis and dogma. It is, you know, a manifestation of, like, of life-giving power. And as we've already discussed, you know, the hope of being like our heavenly parents, of having children of our own. I mean, that is one of the purposes of this life. Now, when we start talking about the meaning of life, I want to qualify, because, you know, that is obviously like one of the great questions of the ages. Mm-hmm. So in this regard, though, sexuality manifests really what this life is all about. And that is, one, I mean, having children. But it goes beyond that, right? Because there are couples who can't have children.
Right.
Right. There are couples who, you know, for medical reasons or, you know, or emotional reasons or what have you, they're not well suited for that. Well, within the Latter-day Saint tradition, that's okay. Because, frankly, it goes beyond having kids to, you know, seeking to bond with another human being, seeking to communicate with that other human being, and seeking out their needs beyond your own. I mean, intimacy is something that is, I mean, it's a relationship that you see throughout many Christian scriptures and Latter-day Saint texts. This valuing how, like, you are in another person's body and in their mind, and you understand them so well for all their flaws and for all their beauty, and you end up becoming one in flesh and in mind. Mm-hmm. And that is one of the reasons that Latter-day Saints place such a high value on marriage and why it's such, frankly, a battleground for contestation. I mean, this is not just any ordinary fight. This is a fight over the nature of the cosmos.
But here's then the catch-22 for gay Mormons. They want that. They want to have sexual relationships within the bounds of a marriage, but they're not allowed to. The only way they can really exist and be true to themselves is to live a temporal, solitary life without sex.
Frankly, that's tough.
Yeah.
And, you know, and this is something I've said, and this is where we have to start talking about how, you know, yeah, we can talk about doctrine, but there's also ramifications for practice. So Latter-day Saint doctrine.
Can I add another thing just before you? Let me just say this.
Sure.
Because this has come up a lot in response to the show we did last Monday.
Right.
A lot of the comments on the website, and you hear this in other places too, equating gay sex with adultery. That, hey, no, we love the sinner.
No.
We don't love the sin. And so
I hate that phrase, by the way.
Okay. We'll explain it then, because it's what people are saying is, sorry. And this is another thing that a lot of gay Latter-day Saints have talked to us about, Kendall Wilcox in particular. separating behavior from identity. What they're saying is, again, we love you, Kendall, but if you engage in sex, which is such a crucial part of who you are, then you're out. Then you're not legitimate. Sure. So work me through that.
Sure. So, you know, first of all, when we talk about, you know, the tremendous burden that is placed on, you know, on gay, lesbian, bisexual, transsexual, and queer Latter-day Saints, it is true that Latter-day Saint doctrine, it does place an extraordinary demand upon them. And it is a demand that is, you know, it doesn't have any equivalents that come to my mind, at least. So as a consequence, if that is going to be an expectation of people who identify as LGBTQIA, then there needs to be an extraordinary support system for an extraordinary demand. Right. And that's why, you know, in answering your second point, that's not how we go about nurturing those who have an extraordinary demand placed upon them. Right. I mean, you don't talk to most people like that. You don't go around saying, OK, well, I love you, but because you're gay. I mean, that's really, really bad. Right. I think of Latter-day Saints in my home ward who were, you know, I mean, they were doing things that got them excommunicated, frankly. And I saw Latter-day Saints rally around them all the same. I saw them uphold them, nurture them, and do everything they could to show them their love, right? Mm-hmm. And they didn't constantly remind them, okay, but just so you know, we really hate what you do. So, I mean, that's the kind of phrase that
does that
say.
Change?
Oh, let me finish
sorry,
real quick.
Sorry.
No, that's okay. That's the kind of phrase that straight people say to each other to make them feel better about being judgmental. All right.
Okay. But I guess what I'm asking is, does that change now? Elder Christofferson has a gay brother.
Yes.
Tom, who's written or talked anyway, not extensively, but he spoke on a podcast about being touched by his Mormon bishop who invited him and his gay partner to come to church. And the question is, now with this policy, they're officially labeled apostates. What happens now to these people? Are they going to feel inclined to come at all?
So you're specifically referring to people who have been baptized in the church but have contracted a gay marriage relationship?
Yeah, or a same-sex
couple. Or are you talking about gay couples in general?
No, that in particular.
Okay.
Tom Christofferson apparently was told by his bishop, "Hey, Tom, come back.
Bring
your partner.
Speak to that.
Yeah, bring your partner. Come back. It's okay."
Yeah.
But now, how does this policy? What kind of position does that put them in now?
Well, according to one account of Tom's experience that I heard, at the time he was not a member of the church. So he was outside of the church at the time that he had that conversation with his bishop. So that would, you know, kind of put him out of the realm of the what we're talking about here, and that is for baptized members of the church. So, you know, for couples who have been married, and again, the handbook makes that distinction. It's not just gay couples; it's gay couples who have contracted a marriage relationship. So, for gay couples who have, in fact, contracted a marriage relationship, I can only speak to my experience, acknowledging that there are a wide array of experiences on this. Mm-hmm. And my experience says that I've seen bishops be tremendous supporters of members of the church who have been identified as apostates, or they've been excommunicated, or they've left the church or one way or the other. And I can only hope and pray and ponder on this, and that bishops will continue to be so, and treat gay couples in the same way that I've seen other members who've either been excommunicated or are facing the threat of excommunication. That's all I can hope, but we'll see if that comes into being.
We've only got about 2 minutes left, and I want to get a couple of things in. So not really a lightning round, but I'll push it to make a quick response on some of these. Forgive me. I wonder, it seems like, if referring back to the the blacks in the priesthood thing, it seems like leaders sort of painted themselves into a corner, and there's no getting out of it very gently. Do you think Mormons with this particular policy, even though it's not a doctrine but a sort of a policy, have they backed themselves into a corner? Is there going to be any easy way of getting out of this for them?
I can say that I have seen this policy trouble Latter-day Saints who would never style themselves as activists or radicals. And I think of Nylander McBain's wonderful piece where it's called Not Peace But a Sword, yeah. Right? Where she said, listen, this policy, it's really troubling us. And we are people who identify as faithful Latter-day Saints. We're not marching anywhere. We're not protesting anything. So I have definitely seen, Latter-day Saints feel like, the game has changed somewhat. And, some have been more accepting of it, and others are obviously much more troubled by it.
A final question. What happens now, sure. Do you think, for advocates? Last March, Elder Christofferson gave this interview saying that supporting marriage equality is different from supporting an effort against the church, so it's okay. Is the church going to back down on that? Do you have a sense of that? There's some concern that it's going to be a temple recommend interview now.
Right.
Where do you see that going, just finally?
Sure. I'm not obviously the captain of the ship.
Right.
Elder Christofferson, in that interview, someone said, so do you see the church's position on gay marriage changing ever? He said, nope. Right. At least that was the wording that was cited in the article. And, based on the consistency that we've seen in the Latter-day Saint tradition, it would mark a pretty radical break for us to ever become more accepting of gay sexual relationships within our doctrine. Could there be a greater evidence of retrenchment? I can't speak to that, but I can say that a line has definitely been drawn. But I hope that this gospel continues to be one for the vulnerable and for the disenfranchised, because that's a Mormonism that I've been taught to believe in.
Russell Stevenson, an historian who's written about race and sexuality, he wrote the article Manly Virtue, which looks at Mormon male sexuality. It appeared in the journal Dialogue. He joined us from a studio in San Diego. Russell, thanks for being a sport. I really appreciate it for joining us. Thanks a lot.
Glad to be here.
I want to also mention this week on Video West, we have a documentary from Scott Raya. It's really a beautiful portrait of what it means to be gay and Mormon. And the story plays out on the campus of BYU. At the heart of this film is uncertainty. It's called Pride and Faith. You can watch it at videowest.org. Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.